Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. You can find my blog and my bookstore and my stickers and my whole show archives and the chat room. All there at scotthorton.org, scotthorton.org/chat if y'all want to hang out during the show. Jason Ditz is going to be on the show to talk about Israel a little bit later. And then also, as I said, Dar Jamail and Marcy Wheeler. But first up today is Michael Schwartz. And he's the author of a great book called War Without End about the Iraq War that was published back in, I don't know, 06 or 07 or something like that. And he's regular at TomDispatch.com. And he's got this new article at Tom Dispatch from 2 days ago. It's running today on antiwar.com. as well. It's called The New Oil Wars in Iraq. And it's not some no blood for oil type thing. So don't get ahead of yourself, shaking your head and rolling your eyes. This is important. Welcome to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Very good to have you back on the show. It's been way too long since we've spoken. And of course, I can tell, I forget now it's been so long, but I can tell from this article that you certainly understand all the wide and varied reasons for the Iraq War, far beyond just, kind of the mantra that, well, Houston just wanted to steal all the oil away, or that kind of thing.
Right.
Although, whatever role that had in it, I'm happy to let you explain. I think that's a very interesting conversation in itself. But what this article is mostly about, and we've got time, what this article is mostly about is what role the oil plays and the oil money plays in the current conflict. And of course, it's incredibly significant. So I guess, first of all, would you like to address what role oil had in the American intervention over there in the first place back? Well, not the first place, I guess the third place back in 2003.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything is a long story. It's hard to make it short, but, the geopolitics of what in those days was called the arc of instability, at least by the American administration. If you look at what the arc of instability was, it was also the arc of where the oil in the world was, 80% of the usable reserves. And the United States, like every other big power, had been trying to maneuver themselves into important positions in those areas for decades. Well, it's going on a century now, but in the decades in the 90s, and Iraq became the central kind of place, the target, especially during the oil crisis in the 1990s, where it became the axial place, and all of the accoutrements around Saddam Hussein not just as a vicious dictator, which didn't seem to bother the American administrations much at all for most of the time, but rather as a kind of what they called a rogue, who had designs on Kuwait's oil and in various ways was a wild card in the situation. And all this became focused way before 2001, really. In 1998 was the first sort of open call by, high-level politicos for a U.S. military invasion of Iraq, a demand that Clinton responded to by initiating an air war against Iraq that was one of these quiet wars that nobody ever really reported on and did a lot of damage. And, of course, there were the sanctions against Iraq all during that period, which themselves did a lot of damage. So when 2001 comes, the key people in the Bush administration, Cheney and Rumsfeld would be probably the most critical of them, you know, immediately became focused on Iraq and said, you know, we needed to go in there and get control of this guy and get not control of the oil in the traditional sense, grab their oil and take it home, but rather in control of the oil in a less traditional sense, which is what got to be called the control of the spigot, which is that the amount of production in Iraq should be jacked up tremendously. And they have incredible reserves there. They might even have more reserves than Saudi Arabia. And so the idea would be, hey, you could kill three birds with one stone here. We can go in here. We can get rid of this rogue guy that we don't, you know, really is not part of the American, what's called, sphere of influence, the way, let's say, Saudi Arabia was. We can put a huge amount of pressure on Iran, which was kind of sworn enemy, and we can break OPEC into the bargain, because what we'll do is we'll just take all the oil fields in Iraq, we'll ship them out to various production companies, and jack up the oil production from 2,500 to 4,500 to 6,500 barrels per day. And ultimately, in their view, the chance, there was a real possibility of getting up to 12,500 per day and bring the price of oil down to about $20 a barrel. At that time, it was about 60. Now it's 90 and 100, and hasn't really been low ever since, which gives you a sense that that part of the goal was certainly not ever achieved.
Well, now, let me ask you about that, because it's Greg Palast's reporting that what happened there, what you're describing, is the neocon plan, as Elliot Cohen and others described it, as they wrote it up at the Heritage Institute, to, like you're saying, break Saudi control of OPEC and all that by dumping the price down to the floor. But then the way Palast has it is that finally James Baker got his way and said, oh, hell no. And isn't this funny, right? It's the former Trotskyite neoconservatives. They want to privatize all the oil. And the lawyer for all the capitalists back in Houston comes and says, oh, hell no, we're going to make this, same as always, a national Iraqi government oil company, and they're going to control it all, and they're going to keep this oil off the market and the price artificially high, because we like the Saudis and OPEC, because they always get along really well and work with Houston anyway. And so, you know, that was where, I think, the way Palast had it, where the Bakerites won over the neocons on that point back in 03 or 04.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Greg and I have read the same documents from the Baker Institute, and I have a slightly different reading of it, all that. But the plan that the Bakerites came out with, which they tried to implement, was to leave the oil, the national oil production, in the hands of the National Oil Company of Iraq, but to have all sorts of new exploration in Iraq, because there's the belief of the geologists is that they have 450 billion barrels of oil, a lot of it under Anbar Province, and that the exploration would be given to international oil companies, and that the international oil companies would, of course, regulate production according to their market needs, and so both interests would be served at the same time. But it would also give the U.S., the international, let's call it the international community, because, of course, Europe had to be a partner in this, would be able to have another turn of the spigot, especially in light of the fact that the rate of increase of oil consumption was going up so dramatically that it was clear that the Saudis could not actually match the production levels that might be needed. So the Baker idea was to have a sort of half of both. One was not to keep them at 2.5 million barrels per day, but to get them up to about 4.5 million barrels per day, but then start really doing the exploration. So the oil piece underneath, right, was moving along, but of course all these plans, you know, the neocons were far more ambitious and you know, far more unrealistic, because they really thought they were going to jack up production right away, pay for the, and use the increased revenues to pay for the war,
yeah,
which they thought would only cost $40 billion, And but even when they figured out it might cost $100 billion, they still thought they could pay for it with the oil.
Right. All right. But now we got to hold it right there, Michael, and go out to this break. It's Michael Schwartz, everybody. He's author of the great book about the Iraq War, War Without End. Got that right. And he's at TomDispatch.com and Antiwar.com today. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of FFF.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right.
We're back. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Talking with Michael Schwartz, author of War Without End, and this piece at antiwar.com today, The New Oil Wars in Iraq. And now, a couple of things to get started on this segment. Michael, first of all, I believe I learned from Juan Cole, who you cite in another context in this article, I think. Well, in a slightly different context in this article. I believe that he said years ago, and I don't guess I ever really double-checked this, that under the predominantly majority Sunni parts of Iraq, there's really no oil. It's all up in the Kurdish region around Kirkuk and down near Basra. And that this was, and I think he started telling me this back in 2004, this is one of the reasons that the Sunnis were absolutely fighting like hell to hold on to the state and hold on to the capital city against the assault of the U.S. Army and the Badr Brigade. You tell me who was working for who in that one. But anyway, but now you just told me that the Baker Commission, or not the Baker Commission, but that's a different thing, the James Baker group, whatever, they had determined that they, or the geologists thought that there really was a ton of oil under Anbar. It just wasn't developed. Is that it?
That's what they think. Yeah, they do think so. And it's the whole. There's a lot of intrigue involved in that, because if you look at the oil geography, what Anbar, which is the key Sunni province, but or the surrounding provinces around there, which are also majority Sunni, there's no oil. Not none. That would be a complete exaggeration. There's, I think, 5% of the oil that's pumped currently in Iraq is in what the United States called the Sunni Triangle, the area of this of the country outside of Baghdad that is predominantly Sunni. 5%, 95% are, about 80% is pumped in the Shia areas in the south around Basra, and the other 15% is pumped in Kirkuk, which is just outside of the Kurdish areas and which the Kurds claim, and inside the Kurdish areas. So there's very little oil being pumped there. The geologists say that the actual reserves of Iraq may be twice or 150 times the size of the current reserves that are proven, and that the bulk of those new reserves may well be under Anbar. So if they ever do develop the oil, it may turn out that the Sunnis are very oil-rich. However, all that it would be in the future. In the current situation, there is plenty of oil around the Sunni areas, and that's very, very important. The main internal refinery is in a town called Baiji, and that's in a Sunni area. The pipeline, the only pipeline that leaves the country, goes through Anbar province. The rest of the oil leaves the country through the port in Basra. The Kurds are trying to organize export directly out of Kurdistan, and that's another source of tremendous tension in the country, because the Maliki government doesn't want them to have that independent source, because then they would lose control of the oil in Kurdistan areas. But there's another refinery there. There's some small oil fields there, and so the people of the Sunni areas, number one, see the oil as a national treasure, not as a regional treasures to start with. And secondly, they see their part of it as something that certainly they should have some share of. So this has been going on for decades. Back under Saddam Hussein, for example, when the Sunnis were the favored group, right, because Saddam himself, it was a Sunni regime. And while there was, tremendous oppression of the Kurds and tremendous discrimination against Shia in that regime, the people in the Sunni areas were also deprived of many of the resources that the country should have had, not as bad as the other places. And they were protesting themselves and demanding more of the oil revenues that were financing the government. I mean, their government is not like the governments in Europe and so on, which, uses taxes as their revenue. These governments in the Middle East that are oil rich, the revenues of the Iraqi government have traditionally been over 95% just from the oil. And so they take all that revenue. The national government has all that revenue, right? And the question is, who's going to get what? And that is really the origins of this latest crisis, because when the Maliki regime took power and the United States removed itself and the oil production began to increase and the billions of dollars started flowing into the Maliki government that were presumably going to be used for rebuilding the country, somehow this money disappeared. It didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. It went into probably quite a few Swiss banks. I mean, nobody has tracked all of it. The American contractors, while the U.S. was there, were getting billions and billions and billions of dollars for doing virtually nothing. I mean, there's one atrocity story after another around that. But once the U.S. left, everybody in the country expected to see the country start to rebuild quite rapidly, and it hasn't happened. But what really hasn't happened is that in the Sunni areas, they've seen nothing. In fact, they've seen continued decline. And so that's really the origin of this current crisis, because the people of these areas began protesting in various forms. You think of a protest and they've done it. They elected local governments. They elected provincial governments who made demands that, rebuilding be done, that their roads be fixed, that they stop having power only 2 hours a day, mm-hmm. that new facilities be there, or that the facilities that existed spread the electricity more efficiently, that the agricultural areas that were devastated be rebuilt, that the water in the rivers stop being polluted because the pollution coming in from upstream was destroying the fishing industry and the agricultural industry. I mean, these demands were made everywhere, and in the Sunni areas, the demands became more and more and more insistent. And eventually what Maliki decided was he really had to suppress this. And in the big high-profile moment, which is 3 years old now, he actually arrested one of the vice presidents, or he didn't arrest him. He indicted one of the vice presidents, the Sunni vice presidents, for terrorism because he was one of the point people for demanding that the oil revenues be shipped into the Sunni areas for rehabilitation and for jobs, government jobs, etc. And he's now a refugee from Maliki being harbored by the Kurds. He busted a lot of other Sunni leaders, and then the political leaders that were Sunni leaders started making themselves scarce. And so the protests moved into protests on the street. And then, of course, there started to be guerrilla war. And when that happened, Maliki shipped his army into the areas, and we're talking about a maturation of about a 2-year process of armed struggle there, into which this group that's units called ISIS or ISIL, they still call it Al Qaeda, even though they've broken with Al Qaeda. This group is now one of the constituent parts. The American media tends to make them the only important actor, but they aren't not the most important actor. They are one of many parts, and they certainly are a vicious, horrible group who have ambitions to be really murderous. But they are all often constrained by their allies and by the local guerrillas. Those have followed things closely. A lot of the local people are part of what the United States called the Sunni Awakening, which was a group of insurgents who, from the American point of view, switched sides. That is, they were fighting the Americans, and then they made a deal with the Americans to expel the jihadists. But the deal also included that the U.S. would withdraw their troops from Sunni communities all over Anbar and keep them in the bases. And so what in effect was that the insurgents in those areas then had control of local politics, which was, and that was the sort of consequences of the Sunni Awakening. Mm-hmm. But when Maliki came into power, he basically cut off the funds to all those groups so that those groups were no longer being funded out of the oil revenues. And so they have now turned back into insurgents. And they're really the backbone of what's gone on. And when you read in the paper that there are all these Baathists involved, yes, because they have been involved all along.
Right.
And
so now we're caught up. That's where we are today. I'm sorry we're all out of time. But thank you so much for getting us caught up, Michael. I appreciate it.
That's good stuff. You know, and stay tuned. There's much more to come, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's Michael Schwartz. He's at antiwar.com today, the new oil wars in Iraq. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At libertystickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and a thousand other great ones at libertystickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. That's libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.